Bridgebank helps breakthrough ideas actually break through and remains dedicated to providing financial solutions to the risk takers, the game changers, and the disruptors. Bridgebank, a division of Western Alliance Bank. Bridgebank, be bold, venture wisely.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mindshift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
From KQED.
Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer, and today on The Breakdown, with triple-digit temperatures scorching much of the drought-plagued West, we're going to sit down with a Central Valley native and journalist who has spent much of his career chronicling the history of farming and water politics in California.
That's right. Mark Arax is here, the grandson of Armenian immigrants. He's written four books, most recently The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. He's also an award-winning journalist. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, Scott, we have a date.
Oh, where are we going?
We're going to work.
To the recall.
Okay. So the recall date for
September 14th.
Yep. Was set just on today, Thursday. And
remember when all us geniuses were saying it was going to be in like early November?
Well, I mean, we didn't know that all of the maneuvering would happen.
The greasing of the skids.
Yes. So we do know now that this is set for mid-September. Everyone will be getting, you know, a vote-by-mail ballot, so perhaps not the sort of same election day as we had gotten used to in the past. But probably better timing for Newsom than November. I mean, this at least gives him, first of all, he won't have to decide on all those controversial bills before the recall election happens.
Good point. Yes.
And then obviously fire season, the drought we're about to talk about. I mean, there's multiple reasons that most of us think, you know, his people would like this to happen.
Yeah,
sooner than later.
I think not that long ago, his people were thinking, Dan Newman, we're looking at you, were thinking that the longer, give it more time to sort of let the pandemic and things return to normal. And then Steve Glazer, who I talked to this week, suddenly said, well, do it now. He's in good shape now. Let's do it as soon as possible. And that message seemed to stick. And so, you know, the Democrats, you could say, put their thumb on several scales in order to expedite that. But, you know, it is odd to have an important election in September, and there's going to have to be a lot of education. And, you know, I don't know how much interest there is. I mean, ultimately, you know, elections are won by the side that has the most motivated and interested voters. So there's some work to do.
Yeah, I mean, although it's weird for everyone to have it in September, so I don't know if that's partisan. I think the bigger challenge is that it's an off-year election period, like whether it was November, October, whatever. People, you know, are in habits of voting at certain times. They certainly hear more when it's a main election. So, yeah, I mean, it's up to both sides. I think at this point, sort of conventional wisdom is that Newsom is in a pretty strong place, but
well, he certainly has enough money. We don't know exactly how much, but it's definitely north of $20 million that he'll be able to spend on, is already spending on commercials and get out the vote and all those things.
Also today, got a price tag.
We got a price tag, $276 million, most of that the cost that counties will bear. But unlike some elections and some of these, in what do they call those expenses that aren't reimbursed? Mandates?
Oh, yeah. State-funded mandates.
Yeah, or unfunded. But yeah, they're going to put it. It is in the budget. It will be in the budget to cover the costs of counties to keep those county registrars happy. You know, I think originally the estimates were more like $400 million. You know, it is a drop in the bucket, I suppose, when you're looking at a $263 billion state budget. But nonetheless, that money could be spent somewhere else.
Can you put a price on democracy, Scott?
I don't think you can.
I don't know that you can. Yeah, no.
Especially if you put it on your Visa card.
I think ultimately, Democrats have tried to use this price tag as a political tool. I don't know how successful it is. I'm not sure anybody's going to decide for or against Newsom based on this. And to your point, I mean, in the $200 billion-plus state budget, it's a drop in the bucket. Perhaps more interesting politically is the governor going at it with his own hand-picked Secretary of State Shirley Weber.
Yeah, I filed a lawsuit sort of under the radar. It was, I think, Courthouse News broke that story this week that the governor's attorneys had filed a lawsuit against Shirley Weber. He wants to be designated as a Democrat on the ballot, the top part of the ballot, where it's just the yes-no. His lawyers didn't fill out the paperwork properly, and Secretary of State Shirley Weber is following the letter of the law. I'm not sure it really matters. I think in the end, people know who Gavin Newsom is and probably know he's a Democrat.
Yeah, like I have a hard time believing that somebody is going to all the trouble of voting in a recall election and it's like,
Which party is this guy in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that that'll be the thing that breaks the bank. But it is part of what seems like a pattern of his team, at least, being caught sort of flat-footed, right? I mean, they didn't challenge the extension of the signature deadline, which is really what got this on the ballot. They seem to be a little bit...
sloppy.
Just, yeah, it's a little bizarre.
It's a good law firm, you know, but clearly those two things that you just mentioned, I think he'd... I wish he had a do-over. I'm sure he does. But we'll see how that works out. In the end, like I said, I don't think it matters that much.
Totally. All right. Just a couple minutes before our break, but we did get two big Supreme Court decisions today. Scott, you've been covering. One upholds an Arizona voting law that Democrats say is going to really hurt minority voters, people of color, people in rural areas. This was not perhaps a huge surprise. We also saw SCOTUS decide that a law requiring that nonprofits... Will you explain it?
So in California, the attorney general requires that nonprofits, charities, disclose with an IRS form, Section B, I believe it's called, who their major donors are. And the AG has always said that they want that information in case they need to investigate for fraud and that sort of thing, kind of an oversight issue. But a couple of nonprofits on the conservative side, one linked to the Koch brothers, sued and said it was an infringement on their First Amendment rights and that it was had a chilling effect on donors who may not want their names out there. And by a 6-3 vote, the usual conservative liberal alignment, the court agreed. And in her dissent, Sonia Sotomayor said this puts a big bullseye on the back of all campaign finance laws, because this ruling, this decision was broader than some thought it needed to be and could be used to, you know, go after other laws.
Yeah, we can leave the political or the legal sort of analysis of this to others. But I do think when you combine these decisions, I mean, these are big issues for the Democrats, both questions that are within that For the People Act, H.R. 1, that is really being held hostage, you could say, in the Senate by the fact that it either needs 60 votes, which Republicans won't give it, or that the filibuster needs to be eliminated to get to 51. I do wonder what sort of pressure, if any, these twin decisions put on someone like Senator Joe Manchin or even Senator Dianne Feinstein, who has been pretty unclear about where she stands on the filibuster.
Yes, not clear that this is a big issue for Democrats, perhaps. Yeah, I think, you know, in the end, in the short term, neither one of those decisions are going to really have much of an impact on elections here in California. But down the road, they certainly could. We'll see if it really loosens up the Democratic opposition among, like you said, Manchin and Sinema from Arizona to not change the filibuster in any way. But they're kind of screwed unless they get some changes, because between all these rules and all these different states, I mean, they're going to have to redouble, maybe triple their efforts to get people out to the polls.
You heard it here first. Scott says it. All right. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we will be joined by journalist and author Mark Arux. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Hi there, I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer, and we are joined now by Mark Arox. He is a journalist, author, and expert in the water wars that have enveloped California since basically its founding. Mark, welcome to The Breakdown.
Nice to be with you guys.
Well, we wanted to have you on. You wrote a book about 2 years ago called The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California, which, as we were discussing before we came on air, is probably even more relevant now than ever. We are in this drought, never clear in a drought how far into a drought we are, but it stands to be record-breaking, a lot of scientists believe. Does it feel different now than previous droughts you've lived through, or is this sort of just the cycles of California?
It feels exactly the same. I'm reading these headlines now, and I have all the clips from 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, and then we had that flood year in 17. It's all the same. If you weren't to look at the dates, you wouldn't know when it was occurring.
That's kind of reassuring in a way, because we do have 40 million people now, which is more than we've had in past droughts. And there's climate change, which of course makes wildfires worse. So, but you're saying, or are you saying, yeah, this is, we've been through this before. We'll get out of it as we have before. No big deal, in a sense.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the lesson of the last drought was to plant ever more crops, permanent crops, and plant ever more houses, in the path of wildfire. So no lesson was learned from the last one. So we're just repeating the story with, and that as you're seeing our own inherent wild swings of weather, now hitching on to global climate change, we're seeing havocs we've never seen before.
Well, I was interested reading some of your writing. You know, I think a lot of us, like you said, we sort of live in this same, what's the word I'm looking for when the same thing happens over and over again and nothing
Groundhog
changes?
Groundhog Day.
Groundhog Day. There we go. But, you know, the Fresno that you were born in, the Central Valley you live in now, is a very different place than the one the Native Americans lived on, that settlers found. Can you talk us back, like, what did the Central Valley look like before a lot of the farming that you're discussing, you know, came there?
So the valley was desert and marsh, depending on how wet and how big the snow melt was. So in my backyard in Fresno, the San Joaquin Valley, you had the most dominant feature on the California map was Tulare Lake. Mm-hmm. There were four distinct tribes of Yokuts who lived along its shores. It was a shallow lake, okay? And the women were able to fish with their feet. The men were on tule rafts with a hole in the middle, and they would spear these fish. So prolific was the fish life that they started farming, the Chinese came and started with their nets farming that lake and sending the terrapin to the best restaurants in San Francisco for turtle soup.
Okay. Wow.
So what happens is in the 1880s, as California moves from the domination of Mexico to the domination of Americans, these settlers come. Many of them are from the South. A lot of them are Confederates fleeing the slavery South. In fact, one of the first colonies here was the Alabama colony. And they started tapping into the rivers, not 30%, 40%, or 50%, but 95% of the river's flow went to farming, okay? And what happened was you started draining Tulare Lake. And then in 1920, the cotton farmers from the plantation South, chased out of Georgia and Alabama by the boll weevil, they come west to Tulare Lake, and they plant a new cotton plantation. And this is why this place feels like the South.
Yeah.
They brought their mint juleps, and they brought their black cotton pickers.
Yeah. Well, in fact, one of those people was J.G. Boswell, who you write about in another book called The King of California, J.G. Boswell and the Making of a Secret American Empire. Tell us about him and people like him and the impact they've had on the Central Valley.
Boswell was a remarkable man. He never told his story. He He basically went by the family motto, which was, as long as the whale never surfaces, it is never harpooned. And so it took myself and my colleague, Rick Wartzman, an Armenian and a Jew, to break down this Southern patrician man to talk. And he told his story. And it was really this the defiance and battles with this lake, because no matter how many dams you put on it, no matter how many ditches and canals, nature still found a way past the contrivances of man. And that lake would come back. And it came back in 1996, 97. And that was my idea for the book. As I drove out to Corcoran and I walked up this levee, this dike, something out of Mississippi or Holland, I got up there and the cotton fields were no more. It was the New Jersey shore, and white caps were whipping past these telephone poles, and nature had found itself again. Pelicans were stabbing at catfish. And I thought, my goodness, this is a book. And so it was really the story of, you know, as I grew up here, dumb to this place, I always wondered why the middle of California felt different from Southern and Northern. It felt more like the Midwest or the South. And this was the reason, this kind of farming, yeah, this kind of plantation.
Well, I mean, coming forward till today, how much I feel like in the political debate over water and farming, you know, we hear a lot, oh, these are family farmers, small farms, you know, we feed America. But you really lay out in your books how much just a few families have really controlled not just the land and the ag, but the water. Can you talk, like, just put us in context here, when we talk about the Central Valley, how much of it is small farms and how much of it is people like the Boswells or the Resnicks who you write about later?
So the valley is really three valleys. There's an east side where the water is fairly easy to tap into, the groundwater. You have smaller farms there. The middle around Selma, Fowler, the raisin capital of the world, easy to get the water from the ground because the rivers are flowing right through, smaller. But for the most part, agriculture in the middle of California is large and getting larger. We're having hedge funds and pension funds from Canada, the Canadian Royal Mounties, coming here and buying huge swaths of farmland. And so the concentration is in fewer and fewer hands, and that means the water is in fewer and fewer hands. And no one uses more water in California than Stuart and Linda Resnick, who own the wonderful company.
Wonderful pomegranate juice. Yes. And she was quite, I want to save them because what a fascinating couple. But the politics of the Central Valley, Mark, you know, it's a very conservative place, although it's kind of purple in Fresno County, but it's generally conservative. You go down 99 or 5, you're going to see all these signs attacking Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. But it wasn't always that way. I mean, you wrote not that long ago about President John F. Kennedy standing with Pat Brown to, you know, dynamite the land to create yet another dam and reservoir. How did it switch? How did the Democrats become the enemy?
Well, my own people, we started here, the Armenians, is fairly liberal. And as we acquired more, we became more conservative. You know, I think there's a kind of lunatic fringe now that has a bigger and bigger voice here, and it's on the vanguard of it is guys like Devin Nunes. I mean, who actually says that the water shortage is not a problem of nature; it's a problem of Marxists and communists. I mean, so what do you do with that kind of logic? You know, this guy every year gets reelected by ever bigger margins sometimes. It's a frustrating place to be. And there's a fight going on between that old valley and the new valley, as you're seeing more and more Latinos rise up, get on city councils and boards of soups. Some of that is changing.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos, here as always with Scott Schaefer. We're talking to journalist Mark Arax. I keep messing up his name because I thought it was Arax.
Everyone says Arax.
His most recent book is The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. I mean, Mark, I wonder as somebody who's lived there for so long, whose, you know, grandparents immigrated there, as did my great-grandparents from Armenia, I should say, Do you think there's a future in the Central Valley, given all the things we've laid out, the drought, the climate change, the fact that really, since its beginning, you know, the beginning of California, we have sort of tried to shape the land to what we want, not to what it truly is?
Well, we built this magnificent system. The Central Valley Project teamed up with the State Water Project. But, you know, we've gone in my lifetime alone from 13, 14 million Californians to 40 million. The system has so much demands on it that it's cracking. Okay. And it's into those cracks that I go in the Dremp land. And so what is the future here? I think we can't have it both ways. We can't be the most intensive, productive farm belt in the country, if not the world, and then sprawl out with all this suburbia. So something has to give. And that's what all this is about right now. And yet we're not looking at what can California sustain? What kind of growth can it sustain as we're building more houses in the very path of wildfires? They're burning down as we're building them. Here in the San Joaquin Valley, we've added so many thousands of more acres of almonds and pistachios and mandarins out of that last drought that no wonder, you know, these guys are going dry, and no wonder the ground is sinking from all the pumping of the groundwater to make up for the river not flowing the same.
Well, and of course, the farmers often complain that they don't get enough water. They always talk about the Delta smelt and other things that prevent them from getting enough water. But there are some people who say, well, maybe we shouldn't have as much agriculture, or at least the kind of agriculture that sucks up a lot of water, like alfalfa or rice.
Almonds.
I mean, they keep planting new almond trees, which are very profitable. I mean, you know, China loves our almonds. But, you know, who makes that decision? How do you stop that?
So here's what's happened to almonds. I've been waiting for an almond glut for 25 years because every crop we've ever planted here, beginning with raisins, has glutted out. And now we're seeing the glut of almonds. They're being pulled out. The price per pound of almonds used to be $5 in the best days. It's about $1.50 to $2 now. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing almonds come out and pistachios, which are a little bit more drought tolerant, grow in. Now, the argument about almonds, I was hearing Bill Maurer make this argument the other day, that, you know, he's having to take shorter showers because of the almonds. But what he doesn't understand is he's in Los Angeles. We're in the San Joaquin Valley. We have our own backyard rivers here. It's that water flow that the almond farmers are tapping into. Now, if he wants LA to come up and over the mountain and steal this valley's water so they can grow more suburbs across the desert, well, all they're doing is repeating Chinatown. The stealing of the Owens, the Owens River. So, so this is what's so complex. Yes, we're all one state, but each of these regions has their own rivers and their own history of developing these rivers. And that's why it's so complicated to talk about this, as a 1,000-mile-long state.
Yeah, for sure. Well, pistachios came up. We mentioned the Resniks earlier. We do want to talk about them because they are, I mean, reading about them, you know, we talked about the Boswells not wanting to be famous. Like, you realize we're all very familiar with their products. Palm Wonderful, the pistachio marketing.
I'd never heard of them until they wrote a $250,000 check to Gavin Newsom's Fight the Recall campaign. I was like, who are these people? And then I saw
your
article.
Come on, Scott. You know, you had. Okay.
So I guess to Scott's earlier point, like, why are the Resniks supporting Newsom when this seems like, you know, they are one of the biggest or the biggest at this point ag owners in the state? In recent years, that's been seen as much more friendly to Republicans than to Democrats.
Got to be with the winner.
The Resniks considered themselves liberals. In fact, Linda, in her youth, ended up copying the Pentagon Papers on her Xerox machine. Okay. So the Resniks fancy themselves as liberals, and, you know, and
limousine liberals, we should say.
Yeah. And listen, they are the new kings and the pomegranate princess of California. They've got more acres now than the Boswells, and the crops they're growing are more profitable than the tomatoes and cotton that the Boswells grow. So, and you know, they live in Beverly Hills and farm up and over the mountain in Lost Hills. And Lost Hills is a company town, you know, it took them 30, 35 years, but they started giving back to Lost Hills and some of the other farm worker communities in a way that no farmers have ever done here. So they're complicated. You know, I asked them, well, why are you giving so much? I'm building schools. And they're not just writing the checks. They're actually building the schools and running these programs. And I said, is it guilt? And they said, well, you know, there's always a little Jewish guilt involved. But then again, if there wasn't guilt, we wouldn't have libraries in the United States.
Yeah.
Or museums. So complicated people using a lot of water. But the thing that the Dremplan ends with a scene where I'm out in the Empire of Wonderful with Stuart Resnick, and I'm asking him, what was the lesson of this 6-year historic drought that ended in 2017? And he said, the lesson is that we can't grow anymore. And yet right out of that drought, he planted more and more acres, and now he's having to buy water from the Boswells.
Yes.
Full circle.
So we have just a few minutes left, Mark, but you know, yes, they use a lot of water. They also need labor, and a lot of the labor in the Central Valley is migrant workers, many of them, most of them perhaps undocumented. How do growers think about this issue of immigration? I'm sure they would like to just have their guest worker program back and be done with it. But you know, when you talk to them, what do you hear?
This is fascinating. This is a kind of disconnect, another disconnect. So back in the day when we had Prop 187, which was going to deny immigrants, undocumented, all sorts of services, school, hospitals, things like that, I went into a coffee shop in the San Joaquin Valley where a bunch of farmers were at, and they were telling me why they had voted against 187, against the very workers that were picking their crops.
You mean for it or against it?
No, they voted for 187 against immigration, and it seems so counterintuitive. And one of them, who was the biggest stone fruit grower in the country, a Lebanese American, told me that, listen, labor will always find a way here, always, no matter what, how many 187s we put in their way. But the reason I voted for it is because we need to send labor a message. We need to let labor always, make labor always feel a little iffy about its circumstances. Hmm. And that iffiness keeps wages down, it keeps pressure on. So that was a lesson in real politics that I had never heard before.
Well, and we just had a Supreme Court decision, right, about labor organizing and preventing organizers from going onto private property. It came out of a Central Valley case. I mean, what do you see? You know, we talked earlier that it is more purple than it used to be in the Central Valley. I mean, how do you see this kind of playing out, this tension of power and the need for work and the need to do work?
We're seeing ever more mechanization. That's the reason why you're going to almonds and pistachios. They could be picked by machine. And even now, raisins, they're picking raisins by machine. Mm-hmm. So labor is, they're going to find a way to take care of their labor issue as well.
Mark, we're really short on time. Quick question. We're in a drought. I'm sure you're very conscious of water use. How do you and your family save water? Don't tell me you have a swimming pool.
No swimming pool back here. I stopped growing a garden. I don't know. We're trying short showers, just like everybody else, and praying for rain.
Praying for rain. We are all praying for rain. So I know that. Well, we're almost to the end here. But you say that agriculture could fade a bit. Do you see anything in the short term?
No, it has to. With Sigma, we have to get rid of, we have 6 million acres in the San Joaquin Valley. We got to get rid of 1 million to 1.5 million to be sustainable. It has to happen.
You think the Resnicks will be part of that?
they'll be retired.
They'll have to be part of it as well. Either that or the state's not going to impose Sigma the way they said they were, and that would be greatly disappointing.
All right. That is Mark Arex. He is author of The Drem Plan, which is now available in paperback. Check it out. Thank you, Mark, so
much.
Thanks,
Mark.
Marissa Scott, thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. We're going to be taking a break next week for the July 4th holiday, but you can find all our archives at kqed.org, and we'll replay one of our favorite shows next week.
All right. Our producer is Guy Marzorati, our engineer, Katie McMurrin. KQED's team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Tovin-Lindsay, Vinny Tong, Otis Taylor Jr., and Erica Aguilar. I'm Scott Schaefer. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Maurice Lago. You can find me on Twitter at MLagos. Happy Independence Day. Stay safe out there.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing, please consider becoming a KQED member. You get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.